The following teaching is part four in a 20-part series by Dr. Ken Boa titled, Answering the Tough Questions About Life and God.
Yeah, I have to admit, it's somewhat frustrating for me, but I'm doing this intentionally to limit myself to two sessions per question. But if I don't do that, as I say, this will be a train that'll never get off, and we'll be here for several years. And naturally, you can imagine the volumes of material that have been written on the question about the existence of God. Actually, there are over 20 books alone that I'm aware of on the ontological argument alone, let alone the other aspects, the other forms of existence of God arguments. And let me stress what I did last week as we tie this thought together tonight. I want to stress that I cannot demonstrably show you that God exists. I claim that while you cannot prove it in the sense of absolute scientific proof for God's existence, and that I cannot really persuade a person against their own understanding, their own worldview, I can at least say, let's take a look at the options that are out there, and let's see where the evidence takes us, and what kind of evidence would be germane to this topic. And again, I'll be arguing that it's a matter more of putting your faith in the right object and discerning that all of us walk by faith. Whether you are a humanist or a naturalist, the naturalist assumes that the cosmos is all that ever is, was, or ever will be, as Sagan put it. That is not a scientific statement, it's a metaphysical statement. You can't demonstrate that from science per se. Science has profound limitations that we often forget. And that there are, we said last week, a variety of forms of knowledge, and each of which require different approaches or means of apprehension. Scientific knowledge is very useful for a wide, wide variety of things, but it will not tell you much about personal knowledge. Personal knowledge is requires different instrumentation, shall we say, different vehicles. We've talked about other forms of knowledge, moral knowledge, aesthetic knowledge, religious knowledge. We have historical knowledge. All of these kinds of knowledge really are different categories of what are called epistemology, or the whole philosophy of how we know. And we were suggesting before that while science, for example, can tell you about the concept of building and developing and the theory behind building a hydrogen bomb, it doesn't tell you how or if you should use one. You see the idea? And this was Oppenheimer's problem that we alluded to last week. Here he was involved, instrumental in the formulation in the Manhattan Project of this powerful instrument of destruction. Rest of his life he lived to regret it, because science by itself doesn't tell you whether a thing is right or wrong. You see my point here? So science, while it has its values, also has its limits. And it's good for us to realize, as we said before, that there are various kinds of evidence we can use. When I talked about this idea of having to be omniscient to know that God doesn't exist, remember we drew the contrast between a circle that represents all knowledge. And I would suggest even the most arrogant person, if they needed to represent how much knowledge they have, wouldn't draw a real, real big circle. The fact is that we do not have all knowledge. We are actually more limited than we might even suppose. But I'm suggesting here that a better position is more God may exist as in terms of an intellectual, and then moving from there to possibilities that God, in fact, does exist. And we're saying, when we talk about proof, I can't give you 100% proof, but there are reasonable evidence, and we've said that cause and effect reasoning is a very helpful means, and we use this every day of our lives to draw conclusions about reality. And I came up with an if proposition for you. The if proposition is a very simple one. If anything now exists, and that's on some question whether something exists now. You understand that. There are some forms of metaphysics in the East that would question that. If anything now exists, something must be eternal, or else something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. You see the concept there. There are four alternatives that emerge from this if proposition. Either the universe is an illusion, that is to say, nothing does exist. It's Lila, God's play. It's Maya, illusion. It is simply not really there. It's just something that is a manifestation that we really don't grasp, but that's not there. It just appears that way. Problem with, as I said before, is that nobody lives this way. I mean, even the monk, even the Buddhist monk or the Hindu who is into, let's say, Shankara's teachings about monistic vision of the universe that says that ultimate reality is basically all one, but these emanations are illusory. Even with that, the guy will look both ways before he crosses the street, I promise you. I mean, the guy will claim it's an illusion, but he sure won't live that way. I mean, and this is a very important principle. I find it to be self-defeating, first of all, to make the claim, because you're constantly appealing to logic and to words and to people, other minds, to say that logic and people and other minds don't exist. You see where I'm going with that? Just as I said before, that the postmodern notion that there is no such thing as real truth out there, that it's merely a social construct, defeats itself, because you're making a truth claim that there's no truth. And in addition to that, you are living in ways that really are not livable in the way you would ordinarily live. If you say, that may be your truth, it isn't my truth. The way I'd want to work with such a person is the following. It'd be a very graphic illustration. I want him to get in my car, get in the passenger seat, and I'm going to get in the left lane, and I'm going to drive, and says, it's my truth that we're on the right side of the road. And see how long he wants me to play that game. That's metaphysical chicken. That was the deal. The guys would get in their souped-up cars, and then they'd see who would be the chicken, you know. Really a bright game. Really had a lot of point to it. But this is metaphysical chicken. See who wants to, how far you're going to play with that game, and see how long you're going to believe that that's just your truth, it's not my truth. My truth is that we are, in fact, anywhere we want to be. And in fact, that oncoming traffic's an illusion. The universe is eternal, then, would be another option. And that's the most popular option that people will buy. That's why we spend more time on this. Let me jump ahead just for a moment, going back to this, because that's where we left off. But the universe emerged from nothing is, in fact, an option that very, very few people until the last 20 years entertained. You can easily see why. To suppose that everything that is just popped out of nothing is really something that really is contrary to all principles of logic and, indeed, of science itself. The most fundamental axiom of physics is called the first law of thermodynamics, which says that matter is being neither created nor destroyed. And for you to buy into that idea that it just whoop, pops out of nothing is for you to say, by faith, that even though, because I don't want the universe to be contingent, I'm going to defy the most fundamental axiom of physics to do that. Well, let's understand, you can do that, but that's a faith proposition, and what's your evidence for it? You see where I'm going with this? Again, it's a question of evidence. I'm only saying this. Everybody, the materialist as well as the theist, lives by faith, and the faith is only as good as the object in which it's placed. I argue then that any worldview is, in fact, is going to be embraced by faith, but the question is always going to be, is there cogent evidence that supports that position? So that's where we would go with this, and I would argue that that recently some people have come up with the idea of virtual universes that have popped out, and Alan Guth's theory of an inflationary universe kind of spawned virtual universes and a kind of a virtual cosmogony, and I find that to be unsatisfying, especially because there's not a shred of astronomical evidence for such a notion. It's a very desperate move. In fact, I find that when you look at the desperate maneuvers, when you see your opponent moving to desperation, it's probably a good sign that the argument is getting weak. You can easily see why. Because up until now, we were saying here that this would not fly. No effect can exist without a cause. I'm simply arguing this, that the universe is a contingent reality. It does not account for itself. I'll be giving you three evidences that actually derive from science itself. I'm not saying it's an absolute proof, but I'm saying that the evidence is on the side of theism rather than against that side. The fourth option, of course, is that the universe was created by an eternal being. That's, of course, where you can easily see where I'm heading. I'm not kidding you here. You already know where I'm coming from. So it's not like I'm... the illusion of objectivity, of absolute objectivity, is silly. In fact, somewhat dangerous. When people have their philosophical biases and don't reveal them, they want to have the illusion of objectivity, but the actual fact is that it would be a lot better to put the cards on the table now so we see where we're coming from, because I promise you, you've got cards that you're holding. And it's better for us to say, here's my worldview, but I'm also interested in thinking through and asking some questions about, if this is so, where would that go and where would that go? And just come now, let us reason together, as Isaiah the prophet put it. And I argue again that in the, let's say, the cafeteria of choices, the options that are available to us, The more I've been able to think of the theistic position, I find it to be the most cogent, coherent, comprehensive, and consistent explanation of who we are and where we've come from. I'll mention a few comments about this. Again, just the tip of the iceberg. As to the universe being eternal, I argue that there are three scientific reasons why it's not so. Evidence for the beginning, which is the Big Bang. And as I said last week, a lot of astronomers desperately were clinging to the Big Bang hypothesis that essentially, the steady state hypothesis, that the universe pretty much always existed as it is. And that has been virtually universally discredited now, and many people against their bias finally had to admit that this isn't the case. Now, the way of avoiding this is not to think about what happened before the Big Bang or what started the matter, energy, and space and time. What started it all rolling? And so we can certainly say, though, that there is consistent empirical evidence that the universe really has a beginning, and that it does not account for itself, that it has not always been there. You can project backwards. Two other ways of looking at this. I mentioned before about hydrogen, that there is a universal, virtually one-way process in which the hydrogen in the stellar cores are being fused together into atoms of helium. And this is stellar fusion, which actually animates. That's the generator of the power, the incredible power that forms what we call stars. And that this fusion, and I won't go into the detail because it goes into then heavier and heavier and heavier elements, that this fusion process uniformly moves us from hydrogen to helium, and there is no significant amount of new hydrogen being formed in the cosmos. Now, if the universe were instantly old, what would that tell you about hydrogen? Shouldn't be any left. How is it then 98% of the cosmos consists of hydrogen, so far as we can tell? So I'm suggesting here it doesn't actually appear to be very old in that regard, in terms of that process. And it is a process that's consistent wherever you look. Again, I can't say it's an absolute proof, but the evidence moves us in this direction. And that, again, it moves us in the direction, not a leap into the dark, but it seems to me a step in the light. Moving into the third area, what I call irreversible decay. And what I mean by irreversible decay has to do with the second law of thermodynamics. And I won't spend much time into it, nor will I go into all the nuances, but just a quick word here. You didn't think you were going to get into a little physics, but it won't be very bad. I'll make it very simple here. That if you have on this graph here, if you looked at the y-axis, and that represents the average energy plus mass equivalence. That is to say, remember E equals mc squared? And so you can then take mass and turn it into an energy, mass equivalence in terms of its energy, and come up with a sum total. That total average energy and mass equivalence density, whether the universe is open or closed is irrelevant. If you consider the average density, is irrelevant how big it is. You tracking with me here? Whether you're not, don't worry about it. That average over time is a constant. It's neither increased nor diminished, that average density. However, the second law says, while that may be true, that the average useful energy plus mass equivalence density is declining as time goes on. It looks more like an exponential decay curve that moves down and then begins to asymptotically approach zero as time progresses. Never quite reaches zero, but this useful, what I mean by useful, let me give you an example. I take something like this book here, and I apply mechanical energy to this book, and I move it a foot across this and knock my pen over in the process. I move it a foot across my briefcase. What's just happened? What happened to the energy that I put in there to make it move? Where'd it go? Didn't disappear, did it? It actually got converted into heat energy, heated up the molecules ever so slightly, and that's now been dissipated. There would be a way, if you could retain that, you could actually recapture a good deal of it if you have a fairly efficient machine to do so, but you could never get 100% back. That's why there's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, because the fact is you're always losing. What comes out is always less than what goes in terms of energy distribution. It requires an infusion of energy in order to sustain the movement. You tracking with me? The universe is like that. It's like a clock that was wound up at one time and it's wearing out. It's as though you wound up a clock and as it goes down, it goes like this. Wound it up here, moves down ever so gradually. This is why there are a very limited number of ordered states on your desk, but an infinite number of disordered states on your desk. And that's why your desk, anything left to itself, leads to maximum disorder, chaos, and randomness. Basically, leave a car alone for 20 years. What happens? Leave anything alone for 20 years. What happens? By the way, you can relate that not only to heat exchange and thermodynamic exchange. This second law, by the way, explains why it is that when you fill a bathtub with water, half of it's not frozen, the other one's boiling. Could happen theoretically, but it tells us that it gets distributed and everything moves to a state of maximum equilibrium. So suppose, for example, I have boiling water in a bathtub and I pour ice-cold water inside. What happens? As time goes by, what happens? It gets eventually uniform. Enough time, what will happen is that coldness will go down and it'll reach a uniformity. That's why it's happening here, that theoretically it's possible that all the air molecules, all the oxygen molecules and so forth, could all be packed into 1 cubic inch over there in this room instantly. And we go like that. Why doesn't it happen? Because this law tells us that things get distributed uniformly. Tracking with me? But the problem with that is it means that things lead to their natural lowest common denominator. Anything left to itself without an infusion of ordered energy will decay, run down, and become disordered. It's what's called entropy. Entropy is a measure of disorder, and time zero moves in the direction of increasing entropy. And so things left to themselves, by the way, you could apply that not just to the cosmos, but to relationships. Just leave it alone. It's not going to get better. It requires an infusion of order in life. Fact is, though, with the sun, we say, oh, but we have a limitless supply of free energy coming from the sun that can provide order in the world, right? Problem there is, though, there has to be a metabolic motor to take that energy and turn it into something useful. Because this sun, the light just flashing down on there, won't do you a whole lot of good. People have talked about, for example, the primordial soup. I'll be generous and say we've got beef stew there, which is actually much more rich in the needful elements, in the organic elements you'd need to provide. And if you irradiate that with sunlight for a billion years, what'll you get? Pretty rancid beef stew. So it's not going to get more ordered. Things left to themselves will not. This is the way it works. Even under the ideal conditions, things do not become more ordered. Actually, with time, they become more disordered. Anything like this. And so what's the interesting thing? There's two interesting points in this curve, and again, I'm not going to spend much time on it. This is an interesting point here, and this is an interesting area there. The reason why this first area is interesting is because I have to make it a dotted line. What is above that line in terms of useful energy here, you cannot have more useful energy than there is total energy. So what you'd have, if there was time before this, it would look like this, where you would have the total energy would be such like that, and at some point, a finite time ago, it began to wear out like this. But you cannot have more useful energy than you have total energy. So if you press it back far enough, there seems to be an origin point. Call that T sub naught, like that. And that before that, if there was time before T sub naught, it would require some universal agency everywhere in the cosmos in order to take randomness and disorder out and infuse order and a complexity within so that things would sustain a perfectly useful state. The only agency that could possibly do such a thing would have to be omniscient and omnipresent, beginning to sound like you'd need a god to sustain the universe before this point. This is not something I'm making up, by the way. This is just... And also, but the other thing you can have... I'm really not making this up. What we have here is the hated so-called heat death of the universe, because given enough time, the level of useful energy in the cosmos will begin to be so diminished that eventually, left to itself, the cosmos will not even be able to sustain the simplest living systems. Ultimately, it'll wear down. Now, it turns out there are more recent estimates that estimate now instead of 5 billion years, we only have maybe 500 million years to go. No, not even that. 500,000 years, I believe, before, golly, what are we going to do? 500,000? Not that it matters a lot for us, but what it means is that on our particular planet, it'll become a cinder. And that, therefore, the solution is to go to another sun and all that. Eventually, you're going to run out of systems. Besides, which turns out that there are an incredibly small number of systems that could possibly sustain life. That's another story. I would recommend you read Hugh Ross's book, The Creator and the Cosmos. The universe is so incredibly fine-tuned that the probability of another planetary system that would have all the conditions needful for sustaining even the simplest forms of life is so small that there's about one chance in 10 to the 20 against there being one in the cosmos at this particular level of understanding now. Not a good probability. But that's another story. In other words, I will argue then that the SETI, I don't care how long you go on it, you're not going to find something out there if my understanding, it's not, again, something I'm making up. It's much more refined tune than we ever guessed it to be. Left to itself, the cosmos would wear out. Scripture, by the way, says that that's exactly so, that the universe is wearing out like a garment, and that God himself will himself invade history, and the redemption of nature would take place when he himself speaks a new creation into existence and pulls this one away. Remember, this existence was spoken into being, according to Scripture, through the one who spoke that energy into being. All things, remember, are slowed down energy, and remember, nobody knows what energy is. Which means that all things can be reduced to something nobody knows what it is. Energy. Very mysterious concept. If this proposition is true, and I think it covers the bases, the only other option you've got is that it was created by an eternal being. And I find that this question, then some people say, wait a minute, that's unfair. Who caused God? You ever hear that question like that? But you see, here's the difference. That God, the universe is a contingent reality, but according to Scripture, God is a necessary being. A necessary being is a being whose essence is existence. Let me repeat that. A necessary being is a being whose essence is existence. It is impossible for him not to exist. In fact, there is never a time when he was not. So to say where did he come from is to limit God to space and time categories. He himself transcends them. Who made the unmakeable being is a nonsense question because he's unmakeable. By the way, there's a difference. He's not self-created. He's uncaused. You get the difference? He'd have to exist before himself to create himself. That's not what we're talking about. He is an uncaused being. He always exists because he transcends the boundaries of time and space. And let me tell you, friends, I don't know what I'm talking about with that. I have no idea what it means to transcend those boundaries because I'm locked into space-time categories of thought. But he transcends that by so much as we transcend a slug. In fact, a good deal more than that. And so we have this revelation here. A cogent revelation of the being who says, I am the I am. When, remember, Moses is asked, who shall I say send him? Say that the I am, the I shall be that which I shall be. The self-existent God. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. I am and I was and I always will be. Unchanging, immutable. Now, I suggest that we can go beyond that, though, to some more positive lines of evidence, and that would be where we talk about the question of personal or impersonal, and some reasons why I think the evidence in the cosmos point beyond itself to even more than just an impersonal being. What I've been using so far is what's called the cosmological argument, variation of that. What's that word cosmos mean? Greek word for world or the universe? But there's a teleological argument as well, an argument from design. If I gave you a radio, and it has capacitors and resistors and transistors and wires and so forth, and said, here's this radio, it was an amazing thing. There it was in a sand dune, and it was, I tell you, the thing was just created by itself. It's the most amazing thing. And you'd think I'd need my head examined, because immediately you look at this thing and you realize, at first you'd say, what does this mean? But when you begin to put it together, I remember when I was once in high school and I created what they called a super heterodyne, which was this simple, silly thing. And I had, my breadboard was too small, so I kind of made all the wires go up here. Actually, I realized I have a great work of art because it was so bizarre looking. I had tubes hanging up here and things like that. It was a rather interesting piece, but it really did work. It's a radio. But at the same time, you'd look at the thing and it would not require a lot of analysis to realize this stuff is not here randomly, that there seems to be a purpose, an order, a design. And in fact, if this wire is placed anywhere else, it will not work. It functions only if it's built correctly. You see where I'm going with this? Let me suggest to you that a computer is very much that way, only a great deal more sophisticated. And let me suggest to you that the simplest one-celled creature or simple, any cell at all. Pick a cell, any cell, whether it's plant or animal, and that cell is vastly more complex than the most complex computer ever designed. I won't go into how it manufactures proteins and enzymes and how it manufactures all the materials it needs for digestion and for reproduction and replication and so forth and information transfer. But it's exquisitely complex, in fact, so complex that we had no idea what it was. That's why Michael Behe calls the cell, the nucleus of the cell, Darwin's black box. Because at that time, it was a black box, and you figure it's like Calvin and Hobbes, and he gets into this box, and it's his time machine. That's great. You know, don't analyze the box. It just gets me where I want to go. But when you press hard enough and say, what would it take? You see what I'm saying here? That black box turns out to be more than you might have supposed. You might have supposed that things just kind of in the soup got together and had formed this thing. It's like saying, and this is why I'm always fascinated when we talk about, well, this planet has a lot of water on it. This moon has water. Next thing, we have life. That's like saying we have silicon in the desert, and next thing, we'll have computer chips. It's about that. I'm not joking here. That's the analogy we're dealing with here. So I'm suggesting here that it's very much more than it first appears. I say that the complexity of the universe is such that design requires a designer. I believe that as I look at it, there's a philosophically absurd position that would set chaos produces order, that lifeless matter produces life, chance produces intelligence, and accidents produce purpose. Now, it's a popular myth of our time. We call it macroevolution. I believe in microevolution, but I'm not really impressed by even the neo-Darwinian synthesis that is now coming under tremendous attack by cogent evidence that shows that evidence from, for example, just from molecular biology alone, if we limited ourselves to that, shows that there are irreducibly complex systems in the natural order. Thousands, nay, millions of irreducibly complex systems that are such that if one part is not right and there in place from the get-go, it won't work. And we're talking about, for example, if we look at the cascade of processes that are required, of proteins and so forth, just to keep your blood from clotting, to keep it clotting without clotting your whole circulatory system, or for you to be able to see all there's a cascade of effects. Everyone's got to work perfectly and in sync and have to work from that way from the get-go. It's true of anything. Michael Behe uses the illustration of a mousetrap that has five basic elements. And you have a spring, you have the little platform that holds it together, and all the hammer and all those things. And I tell you, with a mousetrap that has four out of five, won't work. And they all have to be in place, and they all have to be in the right proportion. And in all another proposition, I'm suggesting here that more and more evidence is showing once again, whether it's a cilium or a flagellum or anything like that, these are powerfully complex systems that require literally hundreds of proteins and hundreds of systems to work together in concert for us to have this movement in these systems, and that what appeared to be cogent 100 years ago, I think it was George Bernard Shaw who made the following statement: give me a million monkeys and let them pound away on a million typewriters simultaneously, and one of them is eventually going to pound out play of Shakespeare. Give me enough time. It may take a billion years, it may take a trillion years, but one of them will. At first, it sounds like it could be plausible. It's the old idea, give me enough time, anything can happen, until you get down to cases and put it with numbers. If you suppose that each million of these million monkeys has a typewriter that has 40 keys, it doesn't matter if it's upper or lower case, don't worry about spaces. They type at an average of 100 words per minute. You feed them bananas and peanut butter and keep them going, and they're doing it 24 hours a day. How long would it take for one of those, and you have these plays, let's simplify the plays, let's take the a play, whether it's Othello and that play, or Macbeth. That play, Macbeth, has four letters. Let's just say that the play has only four letters per word, and that all, so we won't make them complicated. So how long would it take for one of them to bang out the first word, which is just four letters in proper sequence? Well, you only need one out of a million to do it. That's why you have a million doing it. We're not talking a long time, about 12 seconds. Get the first word. Second word, that's eight in a row. Don't worry about the upper and lower cases or about your spaces. How long would it take? About 5 days. One of them will hit it in 5 days. Three words, 12 letters, 100 years. Four words, 16 letters, 100 billion years. What happened? Exponential decay. Because what's happening? Exponential curve of probability working against you. To get 16 characters in sequence along that line, it would take 100 billion years, which is approximately almost 10 times the estimated age of the universe. You beginning to track with me here? Forget about the first act. Forget about the first scene. Don't worry about the first play and so forth, the first paragraph. You with me? What sounds plausible, give me enough time. When you get down to hard cases, it never plays out that way. I'm suggesting to you that the amino acids that are forming proteins, that to get the sequence of what's called specified complexity, because it's not just complex, it has information attached to it. Remember that the information, as I said last week, is independent of the medium. You can, and I can, for example, I could write out a letter, and there's information, but it's not in the page, is it? It's not reduced to a bunch of signs on a piece of paper. Would you all agree with that? In fact, I can take that information, I can scan it. Now where's the information? It's in my scanner. And now it's been digitalized. What can I do with that scanner? I can put it into a program, and now it's in another form. It's now in a word processing document. I can then take that same information, and I can send it as an email attachment. Is it in the email? You see, the information transcends the actual medium. And that information is actually there. It's called specified complexity. And as I said last week, you in the right hand of the double helix that we call DNA, the right ladder, that right side, it's only on one side that carries the information for protein building. Every one of those nucleotides, and there are four basic types, working together, names a protein, an amino acid. Every three of them names one of the 20 amino acids. And this thing builds and builds and builds until you have a system whereby the cell, through that information, can shape and create any kind of protein it needs for a particular purpose and do it in a split second. And I won't go into that detail. But I'm just explaining to you, because it's a wonderful process that's awe-inspiring. We'll transfer RNA and messenger RNA and all that good stuff. But I'm suggesting to you that what's fascinating here, when you look at that double helix like this, and it's moving down like this, and it's on the ladder, and this is one little part of it, that it turns out that when you're looking at each of these nucleotides, and these three, this may be guanine, cytosine, and thymine, for example, that would correspond to a particular amino acid, and it would send a signal to create that. But fascinating that this connection, which is along this line, is independent of the chemistry, because there's no particular reason, chemically speaking, why this would be next to that or that next to that. You have information there that transcends the chemistry. It's as though I had then information plugged in there, specified complexity. Not just complexity, but ordered complexity. Not gibberish, but actually a language. And a mighty sophisticated one at that. We'll stop with that point. The next point that I've got on our chart is that the nature of humans, our thought, our aesthetics, and our morality. I argue, and I'm not going to go into detail here, but let's take the argument from thought, that the human mind cannot be the product of an impersonal process insofar as it's self-defeating, that to argue that the mind is merely the physical brain, which is merely a result of irrational causes, because to do that you're using your brain to say that your brain is irrational. If you put it that way, you're using your mind to say that your mind is actually a bunch of irrational cause. It's a self-defeater is what's happening here. It's like trying to prove that there are no proofs. There is a universal understanding that some things really are beautiful and some are not, although we're now getting this silly postmodern idea that all art is created equal and all musics are created equal. What we have here is a thing called time. The thing called time has a way, doesn't it, of culling the trash? Have you noticed this over the years, the centuries, the trash disappears? Which is scary. How many of the popular stuff in the bookstores today will make it 100 years from now? Precious little, precious little. And what I'm suggesting, that there is then a reasonable way through literary criticism, aesthetic criticism, and so forth, of evaluating a work of art and so forth. There are certain parameters we can use. Yes, there's a measure of subjectivity, but there's still a remarkable amount of order, just as there's even more when it comes to morality. That all cultures seem to honor honesty, wisdom, courage, and fairness. Wherever they are, whether the ancient Greeks or the Assyrians or the Chinese, or more recently, cultures around the world. And that these concepts seem to be universal values. And every time you make a comment on the moral level, for example, every time you criticize or praise, the skeptic says, how could you be so selfish? What's he appealing to? Or suppose I tell the skeptic, you know, Why would you object to the fact that this particular guy enjoys date rape, and it happens to be your daughter? You can immediately see where he's not saying, well, that's just the way I'm culturally conditioned. I can promise you the guy would be mighty upset if he found that out that happened to his daughter. And he'd know that it was right, wrong, and absolutely wrong. You see where I'm going with that. That we do have really a concept of that, because every time we criticize something, we're appealing. How could you be so selfish? Or any other number of things that we use, or anything we say is beautiful, everything we praise, something that's worthwhile. I'm suggesting that we appeal to some kind of standard that we are hoping that others will acknowledge is really more universal than just something totally irrelevant. For example, a person who is, my thing, you know, why are you to condemn me if I happen to be a pedophile? What's that to you? You see, I'm not getting in anybody's way. And you see where I'm going with that? There are certain things that we know that murdering this baby here is probably not a good idea to do. You know, we just have a certain knowledge of that. Torturing babies just is something that we have a pretty good idea that may really not be just merely my opinion, that there's something wrong. We live this way. We understand this. And I'm suggesting that these things require something that points beyond themselves, not an impersonal source, but rather something personal, because you cannot ultimately talk about personhood and suppose, as I see it at least, that personhood is inferior to impersonal forces. The personhood consists of intellect, emotion, will, volition. And seems to me that something that lacks those qualities is not superior to, but in fact inferior to. At least this is the way I look at it. And I'm suggesting here that these arguments don't provide the kind of absolute proof that will overwhelm a person who chooses to reject God. Please understand that. I'm not saying I can prove these things. I'm just saying that there's a reasonableness of faith in God that seems to comport better with the way we live and think and breathe in this world than that the other opposition or other viewpoints are so. We live more consistently as if things really are right and wrong, true and false, and beautiful and ugly. It's in spite of our postmodern culture, if we really think about the way we order our lives. Now, suppose a doctor, though, told you, and suppose you have a choice that you have to make, and a doctor told you you have a 50-50 chance of survival if you take this operation. If you go through the operation, 50% chance you'll survive. If you do not, you'll die within about 2 months. Which one would you take? Most people, they're thinking, would probably go for the operation. What have they got to lose? You see, Pascal's wager, and again, it's convincing to some and not to others, and I'm not developing it as he does here in our time frame. But Pascal's wager talks about the fact that if a person really bets the farm on God's existence and character, another person chooses to bet the farm that he's not existing, the person who does the former, if he's wrong, loses very little. But if the person bets on the other and he's wrong, he loses everything. So even if it was a 50-50, which way would you want to bet? Ultimately, a choice will be made. And as I said before, when we talk about Jesus Christ, we're going to see that to ignore Christ and his claims is tantamount to rejecting him, as we'll see, because you cannot not decide. There's the rub. You cannot be utterly indifferent. As Kerouac put it, remember in his famous title of his book, On the Road? You're all on the road, and you can't get off that. We don't have some Archimedean objective point by which we can look down on all these people below. We're one of them. And a choice will be made. And you'll choose either to move in the direction of that evidence or away from that evidence. But after a while, at the end of the day, it's very, according to Scripture, much more than an intellectual. There's also a volitional component that has to do it. As Jesus put it, if anyone is willing to do my Father's will, he will know the truth, whether I speak for myself or whether the Father is speaking in me. So there seems to be a condition of actually more than just the intellectual, but there can be emotional factors as well. Well, that gets me down to the, I'm suggesting that a personal God provides for me a more satisfactory position for meaning, value, and purpose. But I've allowed you to have some time. So I've boiled everything down into the most distilled nutshell so we can interact a little bit. And I have 10 minutes to do it. See how I squeezed it all in there? Yeah. Gus? Yeah, the idea there is that you have a kind of a clockwork universe. God wound it up, and then he went on a vacation. So he's the Deus absconditus. He's absconded. We haven't heard from him since. Haven't heard him. And Jefferson's notion then would be this: that thus all the accounts of Jesus' deity and the claims to the miraculous are make no sense because God will not actively involve himself in the affairs. His action in the world will be something that's very indirect. Thus, Jefferson's Bible, as you know, Gus, was a cut and paste job where he basically, literally, and he actually took the scissors and cut out all the bits in the Gospels, the four Gospels that alluded to the miraculous in Christ's life and to his divine claims, put them together. What you had was the Gospel according to Jefferson, not the Gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. You can do that. At that point, though, what's his authority for truth? Yeah, and his own subjective notion of what's correct and wrong. But I would rather pin my expectations on the Jesus of history than on Jefferson's reconstruction, or shall I say deconstruction of history. So you have this idea that was popular for a period of time, though deism now has fallen on more hard times and has been more replaced by a more honest position of naturalism. So that either God is active in this world, and there are three ways in which you can do this: directly, indirectly, or by letting things have their course. Or he's not. Question I saw, yes.
I was in a debate with a friend of mine about this very topic, and one of her questions was, if we're made in God's image and God gives you logic, how can you believe, basically, that about Noah's Ark and about the Red Sea and all these things? And I said, well, you have to have faith, which I couldn't really explain versus her logic. And then also, I was asked if Jewish people are the chosen people and God would never leave them, how do you explain the Holocaust?
Right. By the way, it's a good illustration. When a person's asked questions like this, there are variations of these 12. Each of these 12 are categories. The first one being isn't the Bible unreliable here? The second one has to do with the fairness of God. And what I hear you asking is this and this. Let's focus on this one here and talk about this. Or if you don't know the answer, you know what the best thing you can do? Say, that's a great question. Let me think about that and come back. Let's get together and talk about it. This way you give yourself an opportunity to think about it and get some thoughts. Why make it a debate? Why make it an argument? Why not admit that's a great question? I hadn't thought about that. Let's get together and talk about that, and I'll see what I can find. Let me promise you, there are good materials that are out there that describe this. For example, Wendell Berg wrote a 2-volume series called The Origin of Species Revisited, in which he discusses those very issues vis-a-vis the Ark in very great detail. And I would certainly commend that for you. But he discusses that. It's not as preposterous as it at first appears. People suppose, oh, come on, how could that possibly be? As you understand, though, please understand, I don't want to prove too much. You do not have to buy into flood geology in order to be a person who embraces the Genesis account. There are, in fact, varying views within those who claim to believe the Genesis account. Some hold to a local flood, some to a universal flood. And I used to try to prove too much. In a situation like that, I'd say, that's a nice thought. Even believers disagree as to whether that was a universal or local flood. The bottom line is, don't try to prove too much. The Genesis account talks much more about the who more than the how of the created order. I say, let's focus on the most, let's major in the majors, and then we can talk about the minors. What's the major? You know where I always want to get a person? I want to get a person, ultimately, to consider carefully and cogently make an intelligent decision, that is to say, a well-informed decision about who this Jesus claimed to be. You can reject him, but it would be prudent for you to at least avail yourself of the first-hand data, the primary historical documents, because most people reject Jesus flat out of hand without having ever really wrestled with the gospel accounts. And I argue that actually it's far better for a person for intellectual credibility, to examine the claims directly, firsthand, not second and third, to get one's opinion. So I always bring it back to that. There are materials I could suggest along those lines that deal with the Bible and science issues, and one could give them such a book, and they could discuss that on their own. But at the end of the day, the most important deal will have to be the whole matter of who this Jesus was. And, of course, that's where we're going to be heading. So there are good materials that I could refer one to read, and that was one of them that I suggested. I think, by the way, J.P. Moreland, who edited a book called The Creation Hypothesis, would be a very good book to give to such a person that you just mentioned, because it'll show there's a good deal more cogency here from the scientific perspective along the lines of theism than one might have thought there was. Most people have never heard the wealth of material that's available. They have not been exposed to that. Most people have only been exposed to us to, at best, a Sunday school knowledge of this stuff, and it looks like it's found wanting. But I think there's a good deal more to it than that. As to the Jews, the question that was raised there, it's an issue that Paul deals with a good deal in Romans 9, 10, 11. Best account that I know is the Theology of the Holocaust by my friend Barry Leventhal, a Jewish believer himself, and who did the most definitive work that deals with that whole issue of the Holocaust. And by the way, these kinds of things are discussed in the prophets themselves, but we won't go into that. The prophets themselves anticipated that the Jewish people would actually encounter a great deal of horrible opposition, in fact, efforts to systematically exterminate them. By the way, that actually happened in the book of Esther, even before this. There have been a process, and I won't go into the details, but there is a unique condition, and Romans 9, 10, 11 talks about that in some detail, particularly chapter 11. But we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later on. Next week, we're going to talk about why believe in miracles. Next week, we're going to say, haven't scientists proved the possibility that there are any, just all these crazy things, Noah's Ark, for example, all these miracles of the Bible that have been disproved by the Scriptures. Well, we'll take a closer look at that next week. Let me close in a prayer. Lord, we thank you for our time together, and we ask that you would guide us into all truth. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.